This episode is brought to you by 100 Bogart Street. Do you need a conference room for your next meeting? Learn more by visiting 100bogart.com.
This is Eli Sussman, host of The Line on Heritage Radio Network. I've been a part of the HRN community for almost 3 years, and even after all that time, I'm constantly inspired by the incredible voices of our network. Each week, I record my show in the HRN studio made from 2 recycled shipping containers because I'm excited to bring you, our listeners, the most important stories from the world of food. All of us here at HRN make food radio because we love it. This year, HRN is celebrating its 10th anniversary, but we need your support to keep food radio going strong for the next decade. Join the HRN community today by becoming a member. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate right now. You can even show some love for my show by selecting The Line in the designation drop-down menu. Thanks for listening to HRN. Welcome to The Line. I'm your host, Eli Sussman, and I co-own Samisa Restaurant. We have locations in Brooklyn and Manhattan. We've been open for a few years now, but as an owner and as a chef, I still have a ton to learn about running a business, time management, fundraising, growing a business, and of course, managing people. So each episode, I sit down with a restaurateur, an owner, or a chef, or all three, and pick their brain about their life choices, career trajectory, their mentors, mistakes they've made, and best advice that they can give. For those of you listening that are looking to move on to the next step in your career, or step out on your own, and you have fears, questions, and wonder about how to do it, this show is for you. Working the line is about being singularly focused on the food, respecting the product as it comes in, the mise en place as it's created, the pickups, the kitchen coordination of firing dishes off different stations in tandem. It's about working as part of a team and producing the best quality dishes dozens, even hundreds of times each service. The satisfaction comes from the chasing of excellence, the repetition that hopefully leads to perfection. And managing all of this chaos are the chef de cuisines, the executive chefs of the world. But for them, it can't only be a focus on the food. In this role, you must act as a physical and mental therapist, a coach, a mentor, a motivator. You're also sort of an accountant. You got to manage the books, and you're a director and a producer. Basically, you have to do it all. On top of juggling all of those spinning plates, you can often be beholden to a higher power, the owners, if you're not one of them. It's a high-pressure position in any restaurant, but is it more difficult when you work for a larger organization? Does a larger infrastructure contribute stability or make the job more complex? Today's guest is Jordan Terry, the executive chef of Dirty French. Welcome.
Hi.
Dirty French is a French bistro located on the Lower East Side. It's created by major food groups Mario Carbone, Rich Teresi, and Jeff Zelaznik. If you don't know who these guys are, they are behind many, many restaurants. You were just saying before we went on air that there's 18 properties now. So there's
something like that. Yeah.
There's Carbone, Santina, The Grill, Sedel's, Parm. They're all mostly fancier restaurants. Parm is fast casual. It does sandwiches. In your role, you manage a team of 70, and you focus on all aspects of what makes a successful operation. So we're talking about the restaurant hitting its goals, overseeing budgets, food and recipe development, and also paying attention to labor costs. Jordan, you grew up in Florida and you got a degree in food science and human nutrition at the University of Florida. And after moving to New York City, you worked at some of the classic spots in New York, Prime Meats, Frankie's, Best Pizza, a lot of pizza places.
I started in pizza, like washing dishes at a Pizza Heaven, it's called.
Before we get to that first job, I want to make sure that I just want to jump into Major Food Group because yeah. – It's where you've spent the last 5 years, and we'll go back to Florida. I want to hear all about Okeechobee.
That's all right. I try to
Okeechobee?
Avoid it, too. Don't worry. Yeah, you nailed it.
Yes. So since you've been at Major Food Group for a long time, I want to just talk about how you first got involved with them. It started with a Craigslist ad, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Take it away. How did you get involved with them?
Well, I don't know. I'd been a little lost for maybe a year or two. It's kind of like bouncing around, not exactly sure what I was going to do with stuff, and I had always kind of really liked Teresi. I remember like just eating there years and years ago. And then it just kind of, I was on Craigslist trying to like kind of find something, and that popped up, and I applied and got a response from it, and I didn't think that would happen. And then went, it hadn't even opened yet. It was still the under construction, and went to the hotel and met with Chef Dai there, who was the opening chef. And I think in his words, he was like, oh, this kid has no idea what he wants to do. Perfect. And he's just like, he could like, I can manipulate the hell out of him.
Yeah, mold him like clay, work him to the bone.
Yes, and I did not know how much working to the bone it would be going into opening a major food restaurant. It was a lot.
What was that opening process like? Yeah, it's a lot, but you know, what did they put you on a station? What is it like to be prepping as the restaurant's being built around you, and then it opens, right? And then there's no breathing.
Yeah, it starts real early. it's like when we start. Pretty much all of our restaurants, with the way we open, is kind of all of the PM line cooks pretty much start early in the morning and basically make all of their own mise en place in the very beginning of it all. The prep team is very minimal. And so it's like you're picking all of your own herbs, you're doing like, you're making all of your own sauces, you're making all your stocks, you're making everything like that. And it's kind of like, it's a lot, but you just have that ownership, I guess, over everything. And then it's just, you work through the day and race to try and get set up before service. And, you know, you just get family meal most time.
is that really because you want to be just, you want to have intimate knowledge of everything that hits your station? So don't have a prep team just pass it off to you.
Yeah, it's about just kind of having that responsibility for everything and just everyone kind of understanding their music, especially like when you're going through an opening, you're not exactly sure how you want everything to be yet. It's like until you make everything together, it's like you R&D for 2 years. And you make all these dishes, and it's like, this is really good, this is really good, this is on concept, great. And then you start putting them all together, and you're like, why do we have 3 of these steaks with butter sauce? Like, and then you just kind of like, you kind of clear it out, and everyone starts really idealistic with how you want to do your picks. It's like, oh no, this will all be al minute, this will be like this. And it's like, and then tickets start coming in, and things change quickly. And
totally. You realize that maybe you don't want to just fire every single thing to order, right? It would be nice if you could buy yourself a little bit of time with certain pickups.
There's a wisdom to it, to balancing all those things out.
Let's not make every pan sauce from scratch on the line at the exact same moment.
And even just the setup of your kitchen, you know, like we didn't have it's like setting up another pass or something like that. It's just, you don't know what you're going to need until you kind of get in there.
That's the fun part about setting up a restaurant. Did you find when you came into Dirty French that there were, I mean, you try to think about everything before you open, right? But did you find that there were configuration problems in the kitchen?
Oh, a million things. Yeah. This is like, we need this table doesn't make any sense here. It doesn't work at all. Like, we're trying to expo straight from the pass, but it's not set up like an island style. So it's like, it's just jammed up when there's expo and runners like behind the chef and not happy.
Yeah. Like, there's always those kind of
moving fridges
problematic moments where you think of everything and then you realize that you're going to open in 3 days and you have to go back to the drawing board on so many things. Let's rewind a little bit. You're from Florida.
Yeah.
You grew up and sort of near the water, but actually inland a little bit by a lake, is a pretty famous lake.
Well, I mean, people pretty have heard, famous. Yeah,
people have heard of it. Definitely. Yeah, it's big it. In Florida.
Yeah. Very big in Florida.
what's that lifestyle like growing up? It's sort of in between Miami, Orlando.
So like Miami, I've been to like twice in my life. Like it's, you know, it's a 3.5 hour drive away.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Orlando is about 2 hours drive north. Like, so where I'm from, it's kind of like, it's Okeechobee. It's right kind of in the center of the state, right there on the lake. But it's about an hour away from the next town for the most part. So we kind of pretty self-sufficient. You know, we have our own Walmart. We have 2 McDonald's. So, you know, making it.
It's happening.
There's a Home Depot there now. So things have changed. But, you know, there's one high school.
Football town?
One little league. Every town's a little bit of football town down there. Yeah. We weren't very good.
Uh-huh.
Certainly wasn't.
But I'm imagining this just sort of like classic Florida football truck town.
Yeah, it's definitely on the redneck side. Yeah.
Okay.
Definitely.
Gotcha. You said it. I didn't say it. And so it's a 2 McDonald's town, probably not a, you know, culinary center point in Florida. How did you get into food? Were your parents into food? What did they do for their careers? And what in the world prompted you to pick up a food job when you were 12 and continue going down this path?
Well, it started like, I mean, my mom was a teacher for 35, 40 years. She taught middle school the whole time. So she is a saintly patience. I still see middle schoolers. I still don't want to be near them to this day. Just like, you're the worst version of yourself, you know?
Yeah, totally. So, and like, Seventh graders are just
I mean,
rough.
She was my teacher too, you know? It's not that big of a town. But so she was a teacher. My dad was a corrections officer. He worked at the sheriff's department. And then my stepdad was a musician, so he traveled around a lot, doing like he'd play in like casinos and stuff in like Mississippi and stuff like that. Then he'd play at like resorts in like Georgia and like Captiva, and like he kind of did that.
The riverboat.
Yeah, that kind of
vibe.
Stuff.
Vibe. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and that was what he did. And then whenever he was back in town, he would work at with one of his friends who owned a pizza shop there called Pizza Heaven. It was like a local pizza joint, which is not too common. You know, there was the Domino's, there was the Pizza Hut, but that was like the kind of the local spot. It's still there. Still, I ate there a couple years ago. It's still pretty damn good. It was like, it was all real food. Like they made dough and they cook sauce and then they made, it was great.
That's awesome. And you did end up working there.
Yeah. So he would work there like a delivery driver and stuff like that when he was between different like gigs, I suppose is the term. And then, so I ended up getting a job there just kind of washing dishes, like, you know, on like Fridays and Saturdays, like after school. And I just kind of like, I kind of fell in love with the lifestyle. Just like, there's kind of just like, there's a camaraderie in kitchens that is really unique, I think, to a lot of things. And it's like everyone of all different kinds, all different kind of people are all together, different ages, different like education levels, all kinds of things. Like people are so different and they're all kind of like, doing the focus on one thing. And I really kind of enjoyed that aspect of it. And the lifestyle was great. You know, a 12-year-old just living it up. You know, I think I got
as
like
much pizza as you could possibly eat.
So much pizza. I make like, I played around a lot with like I get all, there was the game I try to teach people now. It's like you get all of your work done and then you can kind of start to look at other things that are going on around you. Like you still have to hold your stuff down. And then you can do more, like until you kind of master what you're like. So I would scrub the hell out of the floor, get all the, then I'd go like kind of lean in the kitchen and like try to make a pizza or something.
Hey,
like
let
that.
Me make a wacky pizza.
It would just be for me, but
yeah,
it was a lot of fun. And I get like a Coke at the end of the shift. It was great.
So you, after your first foray into pizza creativity, you're well on your way. And a couple years down the line, you're in Gainesville.
Yep, so
and
I go to college.
Then you're really working at a restaurant, right?
Yeah,
Te Amo.
So I started... Oh, Te Amo, yeah. So I started, like, went to college, and I was kind of getting more and more interested in food. I had started cooking a lot with my girlfriend at the time, or her mother, making like a lot of like Indian food, like, every night. So like, everything we were making was from scratch every day. So I did that for almost, like, a year. I'd be over at their house, and we'd be making flatbread, making rice, making curries, like kind of like that. And I really just got into the whole daily cooking routine, which is not something we did as much when I was younger. And kind of really that and some other friends, like they were my Egyptian friend growing up. So his mom would make like so there's kind of like these like some of these ethnic foods kind of things that are like that are really just homey. And I just spend a lot of time making those. And I really kind of felt forward making food every day. Then I got to college, I'm like, I need money. So I kind of try and find, I'm like cooking for friends, stuff like that. It's like, it's so much easier when you're like experimenting. Like I'd get stacks of cookbooks, you know, and you're making food for like, so much easier to experiment, make food for like six or eight people than it is to make for like two. So yeah. I'd have like, you know, I'd have part like people come over and so I'd bring like 10 bucks. It's like, you know, we're all broke.
Yeah.
And, so I started kind of looking for jobs, and I got one at a really bad cafe in like in a museum on campus. Did that for like 2 months, and it was obviously not very good. But I ended up having a really nice dinner, and like that, and it just kind of blew my mind. Like just having a really, we went out to a dinner with my girlfriend at the time, and just had this really awesome braised lamb and potato gratin. It was just something I was like, how do they make braised lamb? It's like, it takes so long to make. And it's like, that's how stupid I was. But and then I asked the manager. The manager was like really concerned. And I was like, I was wondering, can I get a job here? And he's like, he sent me down to, they had two restaurants in the town. He's like, just go, stop by there. Just like, you know, go interview, talk to him. And I was like, okay. And then like a couple days later, I left the cafe and I was still like, you know, it's not New York City. So like I'm in my car. So I still have like my Crocs on and like a dirty shirt. And it's like, so I roll into the restaurant like and then ask about, I'm here to like an interview or something. They're like, oh, you're here to trail? I'm like, yes, I know what that term means. And then I just ended up working that night and like cleaning shrimp for like 4 hours. And like, I just totally like bamboozled my way into it. And
they were like, some guy showed up in a porter shirt, make yeah. him do something.
You know what?
Have him clean shrimp.
I do the same thing to this day.
If they're breathing, you put them on a trail, right?
Let's see if it works.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Oh, you need a job? All right. We have a task that you can do repetitively for the next 4 hours. See if you can handle it.
And if you can do that, you can. If your brain can survive that, you'll be all right.
So at this point, you're kind of... You have a job because you need money, and you're in college.
Well, that's the only reason I have a job.
And are you actually really framing this as I can build this into a career, or are you not really thinking that far ahead?
So I wasn't too sure about what I wanted to do, still with college, stuff like that. I really enjoyed cooking, and I kind of at some point, like I was going to school like in the mornings and working nights, and it's like... I remember like near graduation, I was like, I couldn't wait to only work full time. I was like, that's going to be the dream to only have to work. It's going to be awesome. Like, and I just kind of eventually just kept doing it. And then I was like, I think I'm going to keep, like, I just really, I loved the, like, would, me and my now fiance, we would come to like the city when we were like, when I was still probably 19, probably the first time. And we'd come here for like a weekend. Like I'd basically skip school Monday. So we'd leave like Friday night and like fly in, or Saturday. We'd like fly in early in the morning, be here for like a day and a half, eating like 12 or 15 different places, like way too much food. Like I could never do that now. It was so gluttonous, but it was like just like hitting up all these like hotspot spaces. I had like the Zagat guide. Yeah. You know, it was great. And I was like, it's like had the map open, just like at one restaurant about to go to another one.
You were doing extensive R&D.
I wanted to know what the standards were. Like, what is good? What is a great potato soup? Like, I needed to kind of like get that kind of like that North Star.
Yeah.
For like what a restaurant can be.
To this day, does anything really resonate with you? Like, did you go into a specific place and say, "Oh my God, I can't believe that I'm eating a X for the first time. This is insane."
I remember we went to Per Se one time. It was it was like middle of the afternoon. We're already eating in like three different. We'd already eaten three places for lunch, and so we're like kind of walking it off. And so we kind of just go up and just look at it. You know, that's how it was before we lived here. And then we just like the door opened and like there's a maitre d'. I was like, so if there's any way we could get like if anyone cancels, maybe just give us a call. And it's like, okay, like this is 2009, maybe 2008. It's like it was definitely very hot spot still. Like it still is. I mean, still packed.
Right.
But and then so like of course that's never gonna work. And so then we go to like three different other restaurants. Like I think we're at what, Bar Americaine, I think we were at. And so that dates it well. And eating like cauliflower gratin and like French fries. It's like 9 o'clock and then we get like a phone call and it's like, could you be here the next like half hour? We're like, oh God.
We are so full.
Oh, we are so wearing jeans and t-shirts right now. And now we got to find a store that's open to get like nice clothes. Like, I don't have a jacket or anything. It's like, so we go to like Armani Exchange is open. It's just like, all right. And so, but we're like, we're pretty buzzed too. We're like, but we're like rushing uptown to go to Per Se. And then that was a very revelatory kind of like, to see how service can be and like how a restaurant can make you feel, like how special it can make you feel and like how much joy and that you can get out of it. Like that was like my first white truffles, my first like caviar, like all these like extravagant things. But it was also just the fact that there was like a little stool for like the purse, like all these, like the fact that we never wanted for anything. It was such a nice experience. And
what's cool is they probably spotted you guys the second you crossed the threshold. They thought, all right, these people are not our normal clientele. I bet these people actually really enjoy food. And this is going to be an incredible experience
just,
for them.
This wasn't just a Tuesday dinner.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's very obvious.
We'll just pop into Per Se. You guys were like sprinting down the street being, I need a blazer right now. I'm going to the best restaurant in New York.
Yeah.
So you have this, you have these revelatory New York City experiences. I assume that that kind of sealed the deal for you on moving back here.
So we, that was one of the things that we went on a couple trips, and by like the second or third trip, Lisa, my fiance, finally kind of, she's like, we kept staying in like progressively more neighborhoods than like, it's like the first time we stayed at like the Hyatt at Grand
Times
Central,
Square,
you
yeah.
know, like, and then we just kind of progressively moved out a little sure. bit further into like kind of, it's like, you know,
you
we're
became,
in like,
you
we're
became in, more in tune with the city.
Yeah. We were a little more comfortable with what we were doing. And so we're like, we stayed in like Murray Hill the next time. And it's like, as we got away from that and started to see just more of just people living life and doing their laundry and like getting like,
it feels almost like a place you could
live.
It's
like a place, you know?
it isn't just sort of like a living tourist trap. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll start talking about the move to New York properly and some of the first restaurants that you worked on here. Stick with us. We'll be right back on The Line on Heritage Radio.
This episode is brought to you by 100 Bogart, a new building in Bushwick, Brooklyn that provides offices, co-working, event spaces, and a brand new podcast recording room. Have you been dreaming of starting your very own podcast in Brooklyn? You can now rent space in 100 Bogart's custom-built podcast room to record interviews, voiceover, and commentary. The room is fitted out with two microphones, mixing board, and a MacBook Pro running Pro Tools. You can rent the space by the hour, and a rental of an hour or more includes a 100 Bogart co-working pass. That means complimentary coffee, tea, and access to your own desk for the rest of the day. So what are you waiting for? Get started on your next audio project. 100 Bogart has the space and amenities you need to kickstart your podcast. Learn more at 100bogart.com or call their team at 718-362-3539.
Welcome back to The Line here on Heritage Radio. If you're just joining us for the second half of the show, I'm joined here by Jordan, and he is the chef of Dirty French on the Lower East Side. And before this, we were talking about Florida and kind of coming up and checking out New York for the first time. And you said in the first half that you were basically you were giving it a shot. You'd come for a day and a half. You'd come for a weekend, and you and your now fiance would kind of get a feel for the land. So you finally made the decision to move back here. She's now a teacher, so I assume that she was looking for a teaching job. And
so she actually went to NYU.
Oh, okay.
So she, well, when we moved here, so then she went to grad school because that's the only way to get a job. So like she did like a master's program in like 1 year. It was like a lot. It was so much.
So her path is set. She's going to be a teacher. She goes to NYU, and you do what cooks do when they come to New York. You set up some trails. So you set up one at Tabla, one at Sambar, and one at Polino's. And what happens?
So, I mean, I trail all of them. They're all great. Like Tabla, I mean, unfortunately Tabla closed not too long after that, but that was a very special restaurant, I think. That was the first big like clean like you know super clean tight like white like bright lights like huge space like have you ever I don't know if you've ever been to that space
Mm-mm.
over there like, it's the one it's it was right next to where EMP is now
mm-hmm.
and it was just like an amazing space and like they had an entire closet of just spices and like they'd scales like in the room like that it was like the lines were huge like 15 people maybe on the line like. It was that old kind of French one with the one that passed at the very beginning and then all the lines kind of perpendicular to it and mm-hmm. everyone's kind of walking all their stuff up like that.
Yeah.
And it was a really fun trail and the chefs were really kind. And So I trailed there. I trailed at Sambar, which was like, I remember that was the first place I trailed, like the day after I got here. Like I flew in, and first thing they had me do was juice a case of oranges. And I was like, I just left Florida. This is exhausting. Like, I'm no interest in that. But, you know, that space is like that basement space. You have to like kind of tilt your head down. You have to like, you have to really squat to get around in there. But that was a really like, that was, a, they were like really aggressive, kind of like focused kind of a cooks. They were really, really like, focus on everything they were doing and very serious about all of it. And I don't know if I was ready for that yet. I was not, I wasn't prepared to, for that kind of a thing yet. It was a really nice trail, but that was, that one wasn't, I don't think it was right for me yet. And then, trailed up Polino's, which is kind of what I've been wanting to, where I'd been wanting to work because of Nate Appelman and the whole, like working with, whole animals and things like that. I had done that in college. We had, there's like a, because it's an ag school, so there's a whole program for, you know, animal husbandry and stuff like that. Then there's also like a slaughterhouse butcher program for teaching people to do that. So, mm-hmm. you know, so I'd used to go there every couple of weeks and break down like a pig or a cow or something like that. It was great because it was a school. So if I messed it up, it didn't matter. It was it was great.
Well, your degree is in food science and human nutrition. So yeah. I assume that you covered some aspects of just like what a dietitian would have to learn and some general chemistry. And then,
yeah. So I focus on the food science aspect of it. You mm-hmm. kind of, there's a, you kind of focus on one of the two. It's like, basically it's one is before it gets to your body. One is when it hits your body. So it's kind of like that's, and I focus more on the food science aspect of it. So it was, a lot of chemistry. It was mostly chemistry and way more math than I ever wanted to do. Much
that snuck up on you.
Oh
yeah, God, that really creeps in there.
That made it really hard. Like especially once I had like decided I'm gonna be a cook. Like it made that senior year was hard to finish. But my mom, the degree is on the wall at home. My mom's happy.
There you go. Like, good. You're like, there's always gonna be a scale around. I can figure out ratios. I don't need all this math. You know,
differential equations have not come up.
Yeah, not very much when you're on the line. So Polino's. Describe Polino's and talk about what you learned there. We were talking before we went on air about how everything came out of those two big ovens. I ate there. It's no longer a restaurant that's open, but describe a little bit what the first kind of few weeks on the job were like.
It was a hugely hyped opening too.
Very, it was
like, I haven't seen anything like I thought that was normal because I just moved here.
Yeah.
It was insane. Like we were doing 1,000 covers a day and turning away 1,000 people. Like it was, and like, it was just press. Like it was everywhere and it was, whew. But so I trailed there and what things I really admired about it that kind of really helped was one, I really love the idea of really working wood ovens. Something I'd been interested in learning about, the whole animal aspect, something I was really interested about. And then when I met all the cooks, everyone was super nice. Like everyone is also kind of, most people there had kind of recently moved here as well. The entire chef team just came from San Francisco. So it's like they helped, like they all had like realtors. They kind of helped, like people would come and stay on their couches for months at a time. And like, it was just this really nice culture of everyone kind of like coming and moving here to kind of together. And
that really creates a team. That's camaraderie.
It really
was. Like you know who's standing next to you, and you know that they'll work hard for you, and you'll do the same.
Five people from that opening team coming to my wedding, I guess, like, you know, like these, it's been 10 years and we still keep in contact. And I really kind of like, I didn't know that was unusual before I moved to, before, because it was like the first restaurant. Then like, I was like, oh, this is how it always works. No.
So you have worked at several places, a lot of spots in Brooklyn. I'm curious about which one of the places you felt gave you the most as leadership training. Because now you're in a role where you are in charge of everything. Now when you reflect, which place do you say, wow, I think I really learned there how to lead?
Management is a very difficult game to really learn. It's a lot of trial and error. I mean, my first kind of like, I ended up moving to like kind of a soup position at Polino's before I left there, and then went to Prime Meats, and that was like my first time being hired like as a sous, and it was a lot to come into a place that had such established people, like such the cooks had been there for a while, mm-hmm. so to kind of like softly like get into it was like definitely a big learning thing, and then After that, like a lot of the smaller places, you learned a lot of really how important it is to be like very clear and specific with everyone individually, because like the small places, like personalities really matter in a small place. Like you can't have this like big swinging like rah aggressiveness in like a place with an open kitchen with three cooks. You know, it's so you learn a lot more like subtlety and how to kind of get people to get what you need out of them without the aggressiveness or that you often find in a lot of larger kitchens. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just a result of it's too large. It's like it has to be really direct and really there's no time for that kind of when there's 15 other cooks on the line, you know. But Prime Meats was a great spot because the chef Antonio there was really good, like kind of like he would allow me to kind of just like he like kind of like fostered an environment where he wasn't like telling me what to do. He just like would allow me to even make mistakes or to figure things out, like, and kind of coach from there instead of like trying to like directly explaining how to do something. He kind of just gave the environment to explore with that.
Yeah.
And then also my Lisa, my lady, is her management because of her education and what she does, like, managing second graders is no different than managing line cooks, as I know that you're very aware.
Yeah.
It's, if anything, it's almost a little bit worse when they get older and have their own agency now and
yes,
kind of like
interesting
choose
point.
Their own decisions. But we reflect a lot on things, like especially in the beginning of all that, we would kind of like, you know, we talk about our days and she'd give me a lot of techniques and tools for how to kind of what to expect from people and then what, you know, just little things like giving two options. That way they feel like they have a choice in it. It's like, you can do this or you can do this, but you're deciding what the two things are. So you're still get, you know.
I like that. Use those classroom strategies in order to create structure in the kitchen
and
where there isn't any.
That's what people
any.
Need. They yeah. need, and it's like the problem-solving zone is something she gave me, where it's like, it's just like a piece of paper on a wall that has like a little script for like, I'm sorry that I made you feel this way. It's just like, go to the problem-solving zone, figure this out. Like, so it's been a lot of that, but a lot of management I've gotten from her as well. And I just, you know, and trying things out.
You alluded to just kind of letting Antonio you kind of make the mistake, right? Do you now sometimes see people doing things and you give them the opportunity to go down a little bit as like as a way to show a corrective measure? If there's a situation where you can maybe describe how you react to someone when they're either doing something wrong or off in your kitchen, how do you address that?
So it's really, everyone's a little bit different. Everyone has different kind of styles of learning, different things that kind of really work for them. And that just takes, you know, a lot of spending time with it. So if people are making a mistake or people mess something up, it's not something I freak out about because that's going to happen. I understand that. The issues are people when they repeat it over and over, or they don't understand why it's a problem, or like when you go into it aggressively, people instinctually come back aggressively. So going into a little bit softer, like, and kind of like having the conversation first, and then sometimes people don't react well to any correction. Sometimes people are eager for it. Sometimes some people need to be shown exactly what to do. Some people need to be kind of allowed to figure it out. Like, there's no one way to brunoise out. There's a million different ways to do it. And I really don't care how you get there. As long as the final product's the same, I'm fine with that. Like, mm-hmm. And especially with new cooks, you start out with like teaching, this is how I know to make this right. If eventually you can find another way to get to this product, fine. But you need to make sure that you know this way. That way, when everything is going down around you, you can still get it done. Like, I don't, like, a lot of people will just out of just habit almost will like always try and change every little detail. And it's hard to understand. It's just, I think it's like hubris. I don't understand it. It's just like,
there is often a mindset that people can bring to a new job. Like, I have seen a lot and I'm coming to this new job and let me show you how I can do X, Y, Z. Or they come in with a certain sense of entitlement. I can do this very fast and let me show you. Right. And that can be really difficult as the leader. You're not only managing the restaurant, but you're managing all these personalities, and you're really, what you're trying to do is just create efficiency using a bunch of people's different ideas.
Yeah, everyone balances each other out. Like when you have a good team, like when you have a really good team on and everyone's kind of vibing, everyone's like all the food's coming out smoothly, like it is a great feeling to like,
totally.
It's like whenever you get everyone together, but it's really tough to get that, to get there. And one of the things I also do is like our sous team has been there since the opening as well, which is very unusual for
very
like
very unusual.
Like, so the our exec sous Karen, she was the opening hot apps cook. Our sous Sosh, he was opening GM cook, and he got his ass kicked on opening. I mean, we all got our ass kicked, but they really had a special place in their heart for being on him hard. So. But these people open the restaurant, so they know all of the culture, all of this attitudes, all of the and so what I do, and they're still there. So what we do is I really try to give them the opportunity to manage these people. Like it's like when I try not to just directly deal with everyone because it's too much. There's a lot going on. Like, you know, it's first half of the day is on the computer. Second half of the day is on the pass. You know, like there's always a lot to be done, and kind of try to empower them to really take care of management of people and details. Like it's like I find something that's wrong, like point it out to them. You know, like it's kind of that's what like Rich and Mario do with me. It's like they find instead of just they're not solving the problem, they're telling me to solve it. So okay. Kind of like try to pass that on a little bit too. So they can grow as well.
And for those listening, it's not even necessarily like you're kicking it downhill or passing the buck off. What you're doing is actually giving someone, you're deputizing them. Yeah. You're giving them the agency to solve the problem and feel like they have the free rein to go about the task at hand,
like,
right?
I have absolute faith in them, and they need to kind of know that. And
right.
Like, yeah, to give them like it's just about empowering them to move into chefdom. Like
it can be detrimental as the person leading to constantly try to solve the problem because you end up probably not doing as good a job, and also you undercut everyone else. Yeah. And then
there's a reason we have a management team. That's the whole issue. That's what we have a team for a reason.
let's talk about that structure, because what is really fascinating to me, and I hope everybody listening, is that you work for an organization that has hundreds, maybe thousands of employees internally at the restaurants, and then probably a whole other team that that basically oversees the restaurants from a financial and personnel perspective.
We've gotten much closer over the past 6 months, me and the accounting team.
So you've got an accounting, there's HR, there's legal, there's marketing. You probably have a VIP concierge team. So you work in a big organization. I'm curious about the things within that organization that make your job easier and the things that make it more challenging, if those exist, coming from a place like Prime Meats, which is a big restaurant, quote unquote, by Brooklyn standards. It's a sprawling enterprise. And now you really, like, you work for a massive corporation. So yeah. What are those differences? How do they positively and negatively impact your ability to lead?
Like, when we first started, like, when I first started with Dirty French, like, I think HR, I wasn't even sure if there was an HR yet. Like, it's in this company's just grown so much so quickly, but it's been controlled growth, and it's been done well and done like wisely. I think like it's our corporate team now is really kind of running strong. Like we're getting some really, I think as we've grown as a company, we're getting people that are really fitting in well with this new growth. Like, you know, opening up 375 really changed a lot for us, like as far as learning how to manage really large operations, because that was just three restaurants in one building. It's like all at once. Like so it's really helpful. Like we have our director of purchasing I work with a lot, because we're, you know, always trying to work on making our inventory and our food costs, and trying to bring down purchases and things like that. So having that resource, and like she runs a team of like three other people, and she goes through things like, we just went through the linen order. She organized all the linen orders for the entire year before and tried to find, like, if we cut 5% here, 5% here, we're saving $25,000 a year, like that. Like,
for people that are wondering what this role is, essentially, this is someone who's processing all the internal invoices, right? And then you're looking for price fluctuations based on your purveyors to find dollars.
We do that. Each restaurant kind of does that. Like, we our sous chef team actually does. We do the receiving and all the invoice management and stuff like that. And then we kind of run all those numbers and then send those off to corporate and they go good job or bad and then we adjust from there. But she kind of helps a lot about buying power and stuff like that. She kind of helps consolidate the restaurant's purchasing for companies, things like that. And then just having someone who can use Excel so much better than me. It is. People with data input while talking. And it's like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Like, this takes me hours. So then she presents these tools, basically. Like, these spreadsheets are just tools for us to use to make better decisions about how we run the business.
Saves you time.
So much time. So that's great. HR is, huge, huge help of dealing with any issues with people.
If they don't teach how to use Excel in culinary school, they should. And your first line cook job, an hour a day, they should teach you how to use it. They should say, one day you are probably going to be a sous chef and you're probably going to lead a kitchen. And guess what? You're going to sit at a computer all the time and it's going to suck.
And it's exhausting.
And you're going to be bad at
it. It's so tiring.
Yeah.
I can work the line for 8 hours.
Exactly.
Fine.
Yeah. If you ask anyone, hey, you want to cook, 100 steaks and 80 pieces of fish tonight, or you want to spend 40 minutes balancing invoices? I think anyone is going to.
It's like, I got some P&Ls for you. Let's check this out.
The, yes, the P&L. So the restaurant that you run is in a hotel.
Yes.
I am going to guess that because it's in a hotel, you have some built-in clientele. It's also an MFG restaurant. It's busy. It's popular. It has a high price point, right? Someone who runs a restaurant that does the amount of volume and the covers and the alcohol that you do, some people might say, oh, he's on Easy Street. Like, they generate a lot of income, and he can order foie gras by the truckload. I'm curious, what are the challenges that you have from a P&L perspective, from a leadership perspective, even though, there might be great positive cash flow revenue coming in? What are your challenges still?
Well, so we have a price point kind of that our restaurant operates at, and that's been, it's been five years. So it's kind of like the guests are pretty much kind of defined what they're willing to spend, what kind of food they want. Like, we can always go higher, we can go lower. Like, we're in kind of a middle ground of some extravagance, some more humble stuff, like things that kind of like kind of a balanced price point. And I opened the grill in the pool, very different game of what we're selling. And it's like, and it's not about the quality is still the same. The technique is still the same. It's just about what products are we selling? We're not selling Dover soles. We're selling black bass. We're not selling Snake River, like 100 day dry aged Snake River. We're selling just like a nice, like 32 ounce Cote de Boeuf. So it's still all great stuff. It's just, there's different levels of basically price points for what people are going out for. And on the Lower East Side, we're definitely one of the more expensive places in there, but we're also trying to deliver like a little bit more of an elevated dining experience in the Lower East Side. Like, but it's been like, we do some foie. We do things like, one way that we kind of manage that is using the more expensive things kind of as little flourishes, and like, instead of doing a side of morels, we'll just garnish something with a pile of morels. Like, it's like, we can't, no one's coming to Dirty French to get a $25 side. That's not what we do there. That's not what people expect from us.
Right.
So that's not what our guests choose. So sprinkling those kinds of things in there is kind of the extravagance. We do that, and that's kind of how we balance it out. It's like, We do a nice foie terrine, and we also do a bunch of other charcuterie with it, and kind of just have this big platter of it instead of just having that. And then so it's a little more expensive, But we're able to, because we make this very large platter, it's for two people, you're kind of able to kind of justify the price because you're getting a lot for it. And then the foie is kind of, the cost of that kind of gets absorbed in by the other things. So that's kind of the way that we balance that out.
We just met, but you seem like a very humble guy. You seem very easygoing. And you're working for a restaurant where pretty much I'm going to venture a guess that 99.9% of the people that come in, they think that Rich and Mario are in the kitchen. And it's their restaurant. But you're running the show. I'm curious, is there tension for you about the fact that you run a really popular, successful restaurant and you are not as well known for it as you could potentially be if it wasn't an MFG restaurant? Do you care at all about that? And are there days when you do and days when you don't?
For the most part, we're very involved, all of us together, especially spending all this time like R&Ding directly with Rich and Mario and Jeff and all that as we're opening 375. So we now have such much stronger relationships. So they're very much involved in it still. Like,
yeah,
they like to come into dinner. That's really the biggest thing. It's like we have meetings every week, obviously, with Rich and stuff like that, because Dirty French is more focused on Rich. That's more of his kind of thing. Like Mario is like they kind of like split it up a little bit. Like, yeah, they're all involved in all of it, and they really help balance each other out. Like it's a great pairing because they have such different strengths, but they work really well together. So Rich is always around, always involved, but it's kind of the same. It's like I present and he kind of helps. Like, he has a great palate. He's got a great sense of the pulse of what people will be interested in, what's kind of trending or not, and for us, especially Dirty French is kind of based on like 80s kind of extravagance. There's always a fine line that we're trying to walk between, like, is this kitschy and fun or is this just 80s trash? You know, like it's a fine line to walk of like, is this exciting and like ridiculous or is this just ridiculous? Like like Mario will come in and have dinner and, you know, get an email with some comments, things like that. We'll talk about it and we'll grow from there. And it's always, we're always within all of the properties and all the restaurants, always checking like that quality control is something that the tastings and the like to get new things in the menu takes weeks, takes if not months sometimes, of just tasting and tweaking and tasting and making sure that it's exactly what we want it to be. And it's also something we can execute, not just making one plate of it. It's something we can do and actually serve like to 100 to 150 people. They're very, very involved in that. Like, they come and have to private parties and things like that. Those stoppings, they have friends, and you know, there's always conversations about what we can do better, what we are doing well, and not just finance related or anything like that. Yeah. We talk, you know, it's like,
I'll get you out of here on this last question. As you look forward down the path of your career, maybe one day you branch out on your own. Maybe one day, you know, Major Food Group says to you, you've been with us for a long time. What's your dream project? Do you know right now in your head what that might potentially be like? Do you have a glimmer of what your dream restaurant could ever be like?
Well, I'm not sure my lady would ever allow that. Luckily, I have that to fall back on. Just like, no, you are not opening up your own place. It's like, I mean, you know, you know, it's work. It is a lot of work.
And totally.
At this point, still, I'm still doing just fine having a small piece of a really big pie than like having the entire small pie. Like, I'm still very okay with that. So, you know, eventually, I'm sure there will be opportunities, there'll be things like that. But I foresee there still being involved in some way, and then it growing, you know, from with investors and things like that, and kind of like a lot of the other chefs who come up through this, like Eli, we were talking about earlier, you know, does High Street. He started with at the very beginning at Terese. A lot of the chefs who like opened Carbone went to Vegas to open that Carbone, and now they're running multiple restaurants in Vegas. Like, there's a growth within the context, and maybe not just specifically the company, but within all of this group of people and all these investors and things like that I could see. Right now, I'm still trying to, my main focus now is learning how to run a business well and kind of like how to run a whole restaurant. It's kind of my first whole restaurant running position. So I'm really trying to focus on that and get that down. And once I, just like cooking, it's like once I have that mastered, then I can move on to the next one, like the next part of it, once that's figured out.
Jordan, tell everyone the address of the restaurant. Where can they find you, and what are the hours of operation?
So, yeah, Dirty French. We're at 180 Ludlow Street, Lower East Side, right there in Ludlow between Houston and Stanton. Big neon sign, big bright pink neon sign. We are open 24/7, really. We're open for breakfast at 7. And then we go through until lunch starts at around noon. Then we get dinner around 5:30. The lounge is always open. Room service is always open. So if you really have a hankering for a turkey sandwich and some chips at 3 in the morning, just book a room, and we're there for you. Don't worry.
Chef, thanks so much for being here and sharing a little bit about your career and your story and what you're working on right now. We appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. You can find more episodes of The Line and our 30-plus other programs on heritageradionetwork.org. And join me here on Tuesdays at 11 a.m. for new episodes of The Line on Heritage Radio.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.